have the Judiciary Committee come to order, please. It's 1:34 on the afternoon of Monday, March the 11th, 2011, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Paskman is here, myself, Senator French, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Coghill. We have three matters to come before the committee today: SB 86, Protection of Vulnerable Adults, HB 127, an Omnibus Crime Bill, and SB 89, Legislative Ethics Act, and I intend to take them up in that order. Let's start with SB 86. We've worked on this bill quite a bit. We have a new CS before us, /X, that we need to adopt. If I could have a motion to do that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilikowski has moved the CS before us. I'll object for the purposes of explanation, and the vast majority of them are found in a memorandum you should have to the committee from my office. And they essentially are cleanup provisions that we went over with a fair amount of care during the last hearing. I think we tried to clarify that there are three sorts of orders: ex parte orders, 6-month protective orders, and permanent protective orders. And so we wanted to make sure we had those references to those different types of orders all clear. Added some provisions from the domestic violence statutes with respect to modifications. And so forth. That's the first change referred to there at the top of the memorandum. The second change, we just took the phrase "at the earliest opportunity" out. It seemed to be redundant because we were talking about something that happened within 24 hours, and there is a potentially chargeable offense for police officers who don't do that. Finally, in the effective date sections, we made clear that the September effective dates applies only to sections 16 and 20, and that's the new reporters and new police reporting requirements per the discussion we had in the committee. So at this point, I'll remove my objection and see if there's any further objection to adopting the CS. Don't hear or see any that puts the CS before us. We have signed up to testify Elizabeth Russo. We also, from the Public Guardian's Office, we also have Brenda Malatini from Adult Protective Services and Scott Serling from OPA to answer questions. Ms. Russo.
Thank you, Chairman. I am the supervising attorney for the Public Guardian section of the Office of Public Advocacy.
And if you just state your name for the record.
Russo, yes. I am Elizabeth Russo. I'm the supervising attorney for the Public Guardian section of the Office of Public Advocacy. I actually wasn't expecting to testify today. I was going to be available to answer any questions that the committee may have, but the Public Guardian section is deep in support of this bill. I think it would help. It would help our clients and people who would become our clients a great deal.
Ms. Russo, thank you. Anything else you want to tell us about the bill?
Not today.
Very good. Anyone else online who wants to testify about SB 86? Anyone here in the room?
Mr. Chairman, Scott Sterling here, OPA.
Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm here to answer questions. I read over the amendments and the changes. I think they're all to the good, and I'm just here to answer questions.
Very good. I appreciate you being online. Thank you. Anyone here in the room who wants to testify, public testimony on SB 86? Don't hear or see any, but we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. We'll have invited testimony only after this point, and I think we just have one small housekeeping matter to bring before the committee. Welcome. And that'll be brought to our attention by the attorney who's been working on this very assiduously.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kelly Hendrickson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. I represent Health and Social Services. I reviewed the CS Backdraft X just now, and when I read through it, I noticed that
Section 10?
Yes, thank you. Section 10 at 1326.209, these are the general provisions, I think.
Page 6, line, I think we're starting at line 11.
Yes. The span site starts now with AS 1326.165, which is an existing provision that basically said you can do a conservatorship, and here's the legal standard for getting a conservatorship. The phrase protective order is used throughout 1326.165, and I think that's why Ledge Legal may have included it in that. But that we don't want that in the span site. We really only want these new protective orders rules to apply to 1326.207 through 209. And that's because there are existing forms, there's existing rules for modification and whatnot, and this would cause a conflict between the two.
Ms. Hendrickson, that makes sense to me, and just to restate what I think you just told us, and I think I just learned a new term, span site. I don't think I've heard that one referred to before. No, I'm just saying. Yeah, that's new on me.
We use it all the time.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, it's a great phrase. Okay, my vice chair hasn't heard it either. Great, so the span site on page 6, line 11, should be AS 1326207 to 209. And I see there's one at the bottom of the page on line 31. There's one on the next page on line 3. At the bottom of that page, and at least those three places, and maybe one more I see on line 16 of page 7. So what we're going to do is I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment to change span citation to read 1326207 to 1326209. In conformity with the discussion we just had about referring to protective orders, ex parte, temporary, and protective orders, so-called permanent ones. So that's the amendment number one. It's conceptual amendment number one. I'll offer it. Is there objection?
Yeah,
Senator Wilkowski.
Object. And I would just note that on page 6, line 16, we are referring to something out of the span site, 1326.185. I don't know if that's an issue or not.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it's not an issue. That's a particular provision that deals with notice, and I think that I don't know that that's a problem. I don't know that that's a problem in this case.
So that would not be part of the amendment. At least that's not. You're not looking to change that citation.
No.
Okay.
No.
Senator Wilkowski.
I would just also note, Mr. Chair, on page 7, line 4, line 8, and line 16, we also refer to 165, and also line 27 in the definition section.
Yeah, I don't think 27 is meant to be picked up. That's a broader array of statutes. But let's go back up to line 16. Is that one of the, on page 7, line 16, is that one of the references you're seeking to change, Ms. Hendrickson, you think should be changed?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Anywhere that it occurs in 209,
right.
I would suggest a change.
Okay. So, Senator Wilkowski, does that answer your question?
And I would also notice a note under page 8, line 16, and also page 8, line 23. We have the same issue.
Ms. Hendrickson, are those changes you'd be seeking to make?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, excuse me, yes. I think you're correct.
Okay. 7, 8. Senator Pascan.
On page 8, line 16, that talks about a central registry. So are there any, between 165 and 207, are there any other statutes that you would want the Department of Public Safety to maintain that central registry of protective orders?
Through the chair, Senator Pascman, no.
Okay.
Further questions? It looks like there's about 8 references, beginning on page 6, line 1, page 6, line 31, page 7, line 3, line 4, line 8, line 16, and page 8, thanks to Senator Wilkowski, we see line 16 and line 23. Senator Wilkowski, and potential others, yes.
Yeah, page 2, line 18 and line 23.
18, yep. 9, 23, yeah. So there's at least 10 references and maybe more that we're asking the drafter to pick up and change.
Can I just ask a question?
Senator Wilkowski, yeah.
Is this simply a drafting issue, or are we changing the substance by taking that out?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, In effect, you are changing substance because now you're taking away substantive provisions from applying to 165.
Say that again.
Mr. Chairman, in effect, it's substantive, it seems, because you are now, by making this request a change, taking substantive provisions out of applying to 165. So it's a question of application, but the provisions being applied or not applied are substantive.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Coghill.
Along that same line, under Title 47 on page 19, under the definitions of protective services, we also have this. And so is it intended that we take 165 out of petition for protective order under the protective services definition?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, no, this actually is Adult Protective Services section and their powers in 4724. So a protective order in that circumstance is different than a protective order under conservatorship statutes.
So we can't make it a bill-wide amendment is kind of where
We can't make it a
bill-wide amendment is what I understand. And Title 18, Title 47 are different than Title 11 in this regard.
Yes.
So if I'm
yeah.
on page, we're on page 19 now, line 18.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to keep that as 1326-165.
Ms. Hendrickson?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, I do think the span site is appropriate there if that's what you're saying. If you're saying eliminate the span site, then I would disagree with you that a span site would be appropriate there, including the 165.
We're going to keep 165 on that location. Senator Mikowski?
This may not be real popular, but I think we're probably much safer since we're dealing with potentially putting people in jail if we maybe get a clean draft of this rather than do it on the fly here. I hate to put the bill off any longer, but I just think if we're dealing with substantive law that could endanger people's rights.
Mm-hmm. We'll hold that thought for after we finish the motion. Right? There's two steps. First, let's finish the work on the motion and the amendment, and then we'll discuss whether we're ready to have the bill leave committee. Further thoughts on the amendment, which is conceptual, to fix the span sites that have been brought to our attention. Senator Coghill.
And that is just dealing with it under Section 209. 1326-209, just the paragraphs involved in Section 1326-209? I think that was the motion.
Right. We picked up all those, but we also went to Section 13.
Which is 1865, which is you're skipping over into a whole different statute. So should we make a separate motion for each one of those?
I don't think it's necessary.
All right.
Further thoughts.
I guess what my thought would be I would feel a little more comfortable if we had a CS with the drafter going through and making suggestions and we could adopt a clean CS rather than guessing on the fly here what should and shouldn't be done. And I know it's an important bill. I want to get it passed out,
sure.
But I'm just concerned about doing this on the fly.
Sure. Well, we've got to make a change, and we do that by an amendment, which is in front of us. Having made the amendment, then I don't think it's inappropriate to see a clean CS of the changes we've made. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm not even sure what the amendment is at this point.
Okay. Well, let's go back and work on that so we're all sure about what we're voting on. My understanding, and actually I'll let Ms. Hendrickson explain so that I don't insert my own understanding over hers. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I could not get through this quickly enough. To see every change. If you're asking for another general statement of what needs to be changed.
The basic idea of the amendment is to do what?
Certainly any span site that, let me start again. The problem is that the new protective orders, the 20-day and the 6-month, are what a lot of these span sites are dealing with, but the span sites now include 1326-165, which deals with just conservatorships in general. The difficulty is the term protective orders is used in 165, and they've always been used, but it's a different kind of protective order than this. So what I'm trying to do is to get to the new substantive provisions that apply to this 20-day and the 6-month protective orders should only apply to those and not to the conservatorship. So in any place that there is a span site of 165, we have to consider a change. And I couldn't get through it fast enough to see all of them. I think we've run into a couple where we wouldn't make the change. But if we want to just walk through, I can certainly do that with you if that's what your request is, Mr. Chairman.
I understand, but want to make sure the committee members do as well, or at least I think I do.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Just for doing it clean, maybe what we should do is take the sections like 209, talk about what difference would that make in the 209, and then, because that's under Title 13, whereas the next time that it's referred to is under Title 18. And probably having the context between those two would be helpful.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that as we consider 209, we take up the amendments for just Section 209.
So the amendment to the amendment is to remove all changes to span sites outside of Section 209. Is that
no,
right?
Inside Section 209.
You want to be only considering those span site changes within 209.
Right.
That is
so that I get
from the amendment. We're going to excise all other portions, remove all other portions. See, the amendment covered the bill.
Right.
And now we're going to take out everything except what's in 209. Right. You just want to consider what's in 209.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Thank
so,
you.
So
thank you for clarifying.
So I'll accept that as a friendly amendment to the amendment. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we're now just considering those span site changes that we're contemplating within Section 209. Everybody clear?
Pages 6 and 7.
Pages 6 and 7. That's what we're focusing on right now. And there's still a motion to change those span site references from 165 to 207.
And, Mr. Chairman, the way I understand it, this is simply a compliance form dealing with protective orders that don't have to do with conservatorships primarily.
Through the Chair, correct, Senator Coghill.
No objection.
Further questions or debate, discussion on the proposed amendment?
And, Senator, Mr. Chairman, I would also say that any change in this bill that is in Title 18 that has that span site would also need to be amended because those only apply to the 20-day or 60 or 6-month protective orders.
We'll get to that in just one second.
I wanted to clarify that as we move
all right,
forward.
All right. I think I got the committee's attention focused on two pages. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask and inquire whether there's and I think Senator Wilikowski's concerns are valid. We should probably see the clean bill before it leaves here. So with that in mind, is there further objection to the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one, conceptual, is adopted. So that brings us to page 8, where there are two references in Title 18 to the same span site. And Ms. Hendrickson, do you maintain that 165 is still an inappropriate reference with respect to the types of protective orders that should be maintained within the central registry?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Before we deal with it, could I get an explanation of what Title 18 is dealing with here under sub A and B? What's the title heading? I'm sorry, I do not know that at this point.
Me neither.
And maybe we can get an explanation of what the operative is here.
It's 1865-540, correct?
Mm-hmm. 1865.
According to this edition of the statutes, it's generally about domestic violence. And 540 is entitled Central Registry of Protective Orders. And you see subsection A there is just as it appears. The Department of Public Safety shall maintain a central registry of protective orders filed with the Court of the State. And I guess I'll just ask, why wouldn't we want to pick up those Section 165 protective orders in the central registry?
Mr. Chairman, because they are, they really are separate in a way. I'm not sure how to explain that, but it's just existing law on conservatorships. And it's not clear how protective order is defined in 1326-165 in terms of context. But we're talking about having a conservator appointed or a single order from the court to have a trustee changed or something substantively different than what would be in the 20-day or the 6-month.
As I was reading 165, I frankly wondered why we don't get the whole idea of protective order out of there. It doesn't seem like the right concept for what's happening as opposed to what we're doing in sections 207, 8, and 9. That may be for a different day. But I guess I understand.
Mr. Chairman, that was kind of what I was looking for.
Right.
Why not register those? So
I mean, it sounds to me like the short answer is that there are sorts of protective orders that don't rise to the level of where if you violate it, you've committed a crime. Is that part of it?
I think so, Mr. Chairman. But it doesn't necessarily involve a third party committing fraud against someone who is the subject of a petition. It's much, much broader than that. And I think it would change the intent, Senator Coghill, of these particular changes to 1326.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Senator, pass me, please.
If I understand what you're trying to accomplish here, is you don't want to have someone's name in the Department of Public Central Registry just because they may be a new trustee or a new conservator? Is that as compared to the protective order issued under 207 to 209?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, I hadn't really thought about whether someone's name would be involved, but just really the subject of the protective order under 165 is just completely different. It could be a very small thing. It could be just having a conservator appointed. How we define protective orders we don't really talk about that in the community. It's never been an issue. We've just always had that term protective order, and now it's an issue because we're using it in a different context. But yes, I think I haven't talked to my colleagues about this, but really I think the intent of the two are divergent, and so having it a registry is more intended to keeping a bad actor from harming someone who's a subject of petition, which is much like a domestic violence protective order. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, then so that the registry that would be kept at the Department of Public Safety with what we're adding at page 8, lines 16 through 17, those are so that the police and troopers can know who potentially may be violating a protective order that the court has issued.
Through the chair, Senator Pascman, I do believe that's the intent.
Sorry, I'm off on a separate line of thinking about protective orders. I guess we need a short IDs. we're back on the record, and we've done a little bit of research, and so we're now, we've adopted Amendment Number 1. We're back to what I'm going to propose is Amendment Number 2, again, conceptually, to pick up the statutory references on page 8 and make those span sites be 1326.207 to 209. And then on line 16 and 17, and on line 18, just make it 1326.207 to 208, because 209 is picked up on the next line. And in other places, that is throughout the rest of the bill, where that span site is used to narrow it. So that's conceptual amendment number 2. And Ms. Hendrickson, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, did I just hear you say that anywhere the span site occurs, that you would like that change?
Consistent with the intent of the amendment, which is to keep prosecutions down to just these new references we're putting in, 207, 208, 209. Does that make sense?
I think so. So it wouldn't include the one on page 19 that Senator Coghill.
Correct. Would not include the one. Yeah. Well, we want to pick up the ones that maybe referred to in court rule changes. I'm back on page 22, although it looks like those are mostly correct, the court rule changes. Page 22 and 23.
Mr. Chairman, it's possible that I'll have a conversation with Ms. Michelle.
Okay. So as the conceptual amendment number 2, is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, conceptual amendment number 2, that brings the CS back before us, and we are going to set it aside to make sure we get a clean copy. Senator Wilkowski.
Can I just ask a question before
sure.
we set it aside, Mr. Chair? Just something I've been thinking about. And it's on section 46, page 21 and 22. And I don't know that we've developed enough of a record to if you could just talk a little bit about the legislative reason why we should have something in here for extreme youth, and what are you considering advanced age or extreme youth?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I might invite Annie Carpinetti up here because this is language that she worked on. Maybe I'll speak to your question.
Great. Ms. Carpinetti. Did you hear the question? Okay. We're on page 21 of the bill, down towards the bottom.
And just for the record, Mr. Chair, it's page 21 and 22. It's a somewhat of a substantive change. The court will now be prioritizing the scheduling of cases based on someone's age and agreeing to or not agreeing to continue trials based on a witness's age. So I think it would be helpful probably to the courts down the line what is considered advanced age or extreme youth and the rationale. I can understand the advanced age rationale. The extreme youth, if you could talk a little bit about your rationale for doing that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, if I can pull it up from my memory. I think the discussion was that for certain victims, very old, who, you know, we have victims dying before we get them to trial, and very young when, you know, a very young child, 6 months is a long time in their lives, that it was in a, you know, if you say a two-year-old, so that we try to just give guidance. This is not mandatory. It's asking the court to particularly consider the victim's circumstances in every case, but to give special consideration to a very young victim or a very old victim and the effect that the delay of the continuance or the delay of trial would have on that individual person.
And if I could, Mr. Right. I could certainly understand the rationale for the advanced age. You want to get the person to testify. Mm-hmm. What's the rationale for the extreme youth? What's the rationale for hurrying up a trial, putting if a victim's a very young, up ahead? I mean, they can't. I'm assuming they can't testify. I mean, is the rationale to wait until they're old enough to be able to verbalize their testimony? I mean, what is the rationale there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, the rationale was really to take their age into account in setting it earlier rather than later, not waiting till he or she could verbalize the harm that was done to them. Just because children time is different for children than it is to adults. And any effect of any bad situation that they're in is much more effect. It has a much stronger effect on a young person than it would on you or me.
And that's what I, Mr. Fakovich, that's okay. That's what I wanted to hear, or what I was thinking, was that if you have a child who's in a bad situation, you'd rather have that case heard quicker.
Quicker, exactly. Yes, this was not to.
Just wanted to get that out there for the record.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Appreciate it.
Good. Good. Mm-hmm. Further discussion of Senate Bill 86. Very good. Then we will set the bill aside and get it back with our amendments in it and see how we did on it. So let's turn now to House Bill 127, Omnibus Crime Bill. Yep. And this is the first hearing on the bill. Ms. Carpinetti, come on forward. We've had a couple hearings on the companion to it, the Senate companion on it, but this has been through the House, of course, now is in our possession. And the bill we have before us is /I-India. And let's turn to Ms. Carpinetti. What's in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for bringing this bill up. And it's correct that the committee has heard SB 72, which is similar. I also have Derek DeGraff here to testify. So earlier there were time constraints, but I just want to make sure that he has time since
there
he's
are not
visiting.
Time constraints. Yeah, we're here for another 50 minutes, so we'll make sure we hear from him, though.
Well, what would you like? Would you like me to describe the differences between 127 and 186, or just go through it?
Let's just go through the bill. And if there are places where it strikes me that it's significantly different, I'll just bring that to your attention, or I'll let the other committee members do so. So thank you. Go ahead and let's just walk through it.
Okay. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill expand the definition of non-consensual contact for purposes of our stalking statute. Stalking prohibits a person from putting another person in fear of death or physical injury by following a course of conduct. And course of conduct is defined in our statutes as including various instances of non-consensual contact. This adds following a person with a GPS device or using a device, either hardware or software, on a person's phone or computer in their home or workplace or vehicle.
We had a pretty good discussion about this section during the overview we got with Mr. Zabodny, as I recall.
Section 3 raises the penalty for the crime of online enticement of a minor from a Class C to a Class B felony if the person is a first-time offender. If the person is a sex offender, which means he or she has already been convicted of a sex offense, it raises the penalty from a B felony to an A felony.
And I think I mentioned earlier that we were looking for the numbers of prosecutions we're getting under the online enticement statute.
Yes, for the years 2008, 2009, and 2010, for online enticement, 15 cases were referred to us for prosecution, 12 were accepted for prosecution. And I probably could get you some of the results, but I don't know if I get you all of them.
That's fine. I'll just say that for my purposes, I'll obviously defer to whatever the wishes of the entire committee are, but I'm not convinced we have to raise the status of the crime, at least for first-time offenders, but I do like the department's idea with respect to repeat offenders. If you're a sex offender and you're committing online enticement, I appreciate your desire to punt them off into another decade, because that's really bad. So I'm much more interested in Section 4 than I am in Section 3, but that's just me. I don't know where the rest of the committee is.
Mr. Sergeant DeGraff is here to describe some of the cases.
He may be able to change my mind, because he always brings us horror stories, and I appreciate the work he does. Senator Wilkowski.
If we could go back to Section 1, Mr. Chair, just on the
stalking.
16 through 19, using, installing, or attempting to use or install a device for observing, recording, or photographing events occurring in the residence, vehicle, or workplace used by that person. Pretty broad language, I think, it seems to me. I don't know. But if I now tell me where this would apply. This would apply to someone.
This is a part of the definition of non-consensual contact, which is included in the definition of course of conduct in the stalking statute. So you have to look at the stalking statute, which prohibits putting a person in fear of death or serious or physical injury by following a course of conduct that does that. And then course of conduct is defined as two or more instances of non-consensual contact, and these definitions are non-consensual. This adds to the definitions of non-consensual or what's defined as non-consensual conduct, and they are under current law they're pretty broad too.
Yeah,
following
look
or appearing
under,
within a person within the sight of that person.
Line 4 is very broad. Line 11 is very broad. Senator Paskin has a comment, and then we'll come back to you, Senator Wilikowski, because maybe it's on the same point.
Yeah, it is on the same point, and I think of the paparazzi, you know, where they're they have a long lens photograph, and you know they're taking a picture. I mean, is this a and I know it's trying to focus on a very narrow, but does it bring in the paparazzi, so to speak, that are taking
through the chair? I think it would not, unless there were some other evidence I mean, you have to prove that the defendant recklessly placed another person in fear of death or physical injury by doing these, by engaging in a course of conduct, including non-consensual contact. So it, you know, this is the third level down in terms of what what the state has to prove. So they are fairly broad, but you know, it's all tied to whether or not this is a course of conduct that put a person in fear of death or physical injury by the defendant.
Senator Lincoln.
Well, yeah, Senator Paskin was going pretty much where I was going, not necessarily paparazzi, but. Is this an objective standard or subjective standard? In other words, if I out there with my iPhone and I take a picture of someone in their car, I'm taking a photograph. I'm using a device to take a photograph of someone's vehicle. It's, by through the glass, I'm seeing inside their vehicle. If that is the person inside the vehicle, if they think subjectively that I'm trying to harass them, then have I committed the crime, or is it more of an objective standard?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, I think it's more of an objective.
So a reasonable person
yes.
would have thought that I was trying to harm them in some
yes.
way.
It's difficult to prove stalking cases. They're not yeah. they're not easy prosecutions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it what looks like normal conduct, except for there's, you know I've threatened to kill you in the past. You know I've threatened that, and now I'm outside your house holding a rose. Mm-hmm. Well, holding a rose is not threatening at all, except for the earlier, life threat or it's assault or act of vandalism. It's highly contextual, mm-hmm. and yet, you know, if you torched someone's car last week and you show up outside their house, holding a match, that looks pretty scary. Senator Lankowski.
Well, but that's actually an interesting hypothetical. Let's say someone threatened to kill someone, and then they went up to their car and they did have a rose. I don't think that are they violating the statute. But if I walk up to your car or they walk up to your car and they start snapping pictures, then they have violated the statute. Is that a fair?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, this is installing a device in the car or in the house or in the office that would...
Well, it says using, installing, or attempting to use or install a device for observing, recording, or photographing. So if I'm using a device to photograph, if I'm taking a...
Occurring in the residence... Yeah, well, I see you're right. You're right. Occurring in the residence, vehicle, or workplace. Well, I think it's all in the context of where this fits in the stalking statute. I think these additions are... The intent was to... take into account modern technology that weren't taken into account when the statute was drafted, but I would say that these additions are more limited than current law.
Let's look at G, and think of how broad G could be on page 2, line 12. Placing an object on or delivering an object to property owned, leased, or occupied by the person. I mean, it could be extremely mild. Again, you know, a prosecutor is going to have to convince a jury that there was something threatening about that, right? I mean, that's the hurdle you have to get over. Is that what could be extremely innocuous is somehow placed into a highly dangerous context by a broad course of conduct.
And some, it might help just for you to read the stalking statute to begin with, which is 1141-270.
Right.
To read what we start out with, and then we get down to these instances of non-consensual contact. Let's see.
So let's keep
going.
Further questions on this section? Yeah, we're obviously going to think about it. Thank you. Keep going.
Section 5 raises the crime of unlawful exploitation of a minor, and that is creating pornography using minors. Right now it's an A felony if it's a second-time offender and a B felony if it's a first-time offender. This raises this conduct to an A felony for all offenders.
Always an A felony. Yeah.
Section 6 is what I considered a conforming piece in the bill. It addresses the crime of endangering the welfare of a child. Right now, current law prohibits a person from leaving a child under 16 years old with somebody, another person that is required to register as a sex offender or has been charged for a sex offense. This adds child kidnapper to the list, which is you have to register as a child kidnapper. In most cases of child kidnapping involves sexual abuse. The House Judiciary Committee made a couple of minor drafting changes, which I think are fine, make it clear that the person either is required to register is under the charge of these offenses, not necessarily has been charged. They may have been later acquitted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Just on that point, how does this go to play with those who have child custody disputes and they get charged with kidnapping because they're having a dispute over who gets to...
Who gets custody. Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill, people who get into disputes about their own children are not charged with kidnapping. They're charged with custodial interference. So they don't have to register as sex offenders or child kidnappers.
I misunderstood. I thought there was a kidnapping charge involved in some of that. So
I think in the past it used to be alleged that way by the angry parent, one angry parent.
Okay.
But now that those instances are charged as custodial interference. Section 7 deals with what is commonly described as sexting, but it's actually sending an explicit image of a minor. I know the committee had some questions about it in the Senate version. The House version changed this provision in a couple of important ways. First of all, it requires the state to prove the culpable mental state that the person sent the image with an intent to annoy or humiliate another person, and it removed the felony offense so that now there are two levels of offense, a B misdemeanor if the person sends the image, an A misdemeanor if a person puts the image on an internet website that is accessible to the public.
Sure.
Senator Wilikowski.
I've never seen a bill that published that criminalized the intent to annoy or humiliate. Is that
turn the page, Senator Wilkowski, because harassment's been on the books for a long time.
Same thing.
Is that the same language, intent to annoy?
Actually, Ms. Carpinetti is right. There's a difference. It's harass or annoy as far as harassment goes, and I guess it should say harass, it being the kind of harassment. But with this one, it's annoy or humiliate. So intent is always very, very hard to prove.
It is hard to prove, and the really positive thing that results of this culpable mental state is that you avoid all the problems that we discussed at the last hearing about baby pictures and photographs that parents would send to brag about their children and that sort of thing.
Because there's no intent to annoy or humiliate. Senator Wilkowski.
So again, the intent to annoy is that if you have a young child who wouldn't be able to understand, wouldn't feel annoyance perhaps or humiliation from a photograph going out. Please explain the intent, how that works.
Well, if we couldn't prove that you acted with an intent to annoy or humiliate a child, because we probably couldn't if the child was unable to feel annoyance or humiliation, we would not bring a charge.
So this does nothing to prevent the problems with, let's say, kids 1, 2, 3 years old. By 4 years old, they start to feel some annoyance. But
well, it does because for
hold
baby
your,
pictures.
Hold your child and look out.
Well, then.
Just sorry. And
then Section 8 just is a conforming amendment to show that the conduct in the prior section is excluded from the harassment prohibition.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Has this the intent language been proven in other jurisdictions, any states, federal law that we know of?
Through the chair, not that I know of. A lot of states are like we are struggling with how to address this issue. I have not seen a decision addressing this particular language, although we do have in our harassment law, we have had cases where people have been convicted of acting with intent to annoy or harass another person. I don't know that. So there is some precedent there for that term. Section 9 adopts two new crimes, misconduct involving confidential information in the first and second degree. The second degree offense prohibits a person from obtaining information that is confidential, defined confidential by law, without the consent of the owner of that information. And confidential is defined as confidential by law, and there are a number of areas in our statutes that define confidential information. The ones that come to mind to me are China, child in need of aid information, juvenile justice information, APSIN information. But there are various other places in our statutes that have confidential information, also information that's encoded on an access device.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Just back to Section 7. The intent to annoy or humiliate another person, does it have to be the person who the photograph was of? In other words, you take a picture of a 4-year-old, that's explicit, you send it out, or let's make it a 2-year-old, that's explicit, you send it out. It probably doesn't annoy the 2-year-old, but it annoys the parents. Would that be a crime under this?
Through the chair, no. And I'm glad I have a chance to explain this. That on lines 28 and 29 of page 3, it says, to annoy or humiliate another person. And then it describes sending an image of that other person. And it's meant to relate back to who you intend to annoy or humiliate.
So we will have to consider whether we want to make it a crime to annoy a parent by sending out an indecent picture of their child or a picture of a child that depicts their genitals, anus, or female breast.
Yeah, what happens if the 14-year-old doesn't object and the parent
does? Right.
And the parent is saying they have no standing?
The way the statute reads is that it's got to annoy or humiliate the person whose picture has been sent out. That's the way I read it.
That's the way I read
that's,
it, too.
That's and who we're after. That's who we're protecting, at least. So that's who we're making it a crime.
Yes.
Right? And as soon as you extend it to somebody else, wow. Let's just put it that way.
Slippery slope.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I mean, this is going to be tricky enough. Go ahead.
Misconduct in the first degree, misconduct involving confidential information in the first degree would make it a crime to commit the second degree offense with the intent to use the information to commit a crime or to obtain a benefit to which the person is not entitled or to injure another person. And those terms are well defined in our theft laws.
And can you just tell me sort of generically what this picks up that current statute doesn't cover?
Well, we have statutes involving identity theft, that using an access device. This is just obtaining the information, having no right to do so. So it's kind of a step down, and they're misdemeanor offenses.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski.
How do you define confidential information?
Well, it's defined on page 5, line 10, as information classified as confidential by law. And our statutes have many sections, and I think I scanned several examples to the committee that describe information as confidential. And so those that are defined in our statutes as confidential or federal law I'm thinking of what other jurisdiction it would be. I think it would be state or federal law. And also in information that's encoded on an access device. Now, if you have information on an access device that it's okay with you, that you give to the store clerk and say, fine, take it, that's okay. But one of the elements that we have to prove in this crime is that it was against the, without the legal authority of the
consent.
Owner.
Right. So you can share it. It's up to you if you want to share it. But if you're not sharing it, someone nabs it.
Right. Section 10 We're not sure if this is absolutely necessary, but we thought it was probably a good idea to clarify that some of these crimes can be easily committed by people outside the state, like online enticement of a minor,
sure,
or sending an explicit image of a minor. If they're committed on the victim that was in the state, they can be prosecuted by the state.
Mm-hmm. Let's just go back to Section 9 for a second, misconduct involving confidential information. Are the passwords we use to protect our bank accounts or even email accounts, do you know if those are defined as confidential information?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, but I will try and find out.
Yeah, it's a common example we all think of. Please continue.
Sure. Section 11 is in this bill, House Bill 127, in House Finance Committee, was added the provisions of House Bill 175, which corrected four instances of disagreement between our statutes and our court rules. Probably the most important is the 24-48 hour rule that the legislature passed last year. Under our law, since statehood, the state has been required to bring a person arrested in front of a judicial officer without unnecessary delay. And then our law has said, or within 24 hours. This the bill that passed last year, the revision of our bail statutes, changed the court rules to 48 hours, but we neglected to change the statutes to 48 hours. And this bill in two places does that.
So you get to have the fight all over again. Sorry.
I know. And it does so in our arrest statutes and also in our extradition statutes. They have the same provision.
Sure. And we'll probably discuss this at greater length, but if there's a couple questions you want to touch on now, let's go ahead and do that.
There's Supreme Court cases that talk about unreasonable delays, and uh-huh. Do we have an opinion that this may be unconstitutional? Can you talk about the constitutionality of this?
Well, we 48 hours and 72 hours have been upheld by the United States Supreme Court and other state Supreme Courts, too. We don't have an opinion in our state because it's never been 48 hours before. But we expect that that this would be considered constitutional, especially since we are still required to bring them in front of a judicial officer without unnecessary delay. So, there's been concern expressed that this will make the system lazy and they won't, they might wait. I don't think that... that fear is valid because we still have to bring them in without unnecessary delay. So as soon as it's possible to get a person before a judicial officer is when we would want to do that.
Senator Pasquin has a question.
Just following up in our earlier discussions, a year from now, if this passes, or a year after, whenever a similar bill were to pass, I would like to know how many occurred within 24 hours and how many were occurring within 48 hours, because if all of a sudden you get 75% are now up to 48 hours, and
it would be a strong indication that
the system is just being lazy and holding people in jail, and uh-huh. and I think that's not the intent. At least it wouldn't be my intent, and but at the same
certainly
time
not,
wanting, to give,
not ours either.
Wanting to give sufficient latitude so that the appropriate people, you're not letting people go, so to speak, because you're not doing it within 24 versus 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say that from what we know in Fairbanks, they have been following the court rule rather than the statute.
The 48.
And so far, there's been only one instance when it was over 24 hours, and that was when the ice storm struck Fairbanks, and the court building was, I think everything was closed down in Fairbanks. So that was the only instance thus far that people were brought in over 24 hours.
I'll go ahead.
Again, I would like to think that type of prompt handling would continue mm-hmm. and not, so to speak, fall back just for the sake of falling back.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing that might make you feel better is that we include weekends and holidays. So we have arraignments every day, including weekends and holidays. Some states have, 48 hours, excluding weekends and holidays. So, you know, we're having arraignments every day. We're bringing people in when they should be arraigned.
I'll tell the committee, and I spoke to Ms. Carpinetti about this earlier, it's no surprise to her, that I'm thinking about 36 hours as something of a compromise, and while it seems like it's just splitting the difference, it essentially, I think, gives the Department of Law and police law enforcement sort of a full working day to prepare charges against an individual, kind of no matter what time of the hour they're arrested. Part of the problem comes, I think, now when you arrest someone at, say, 3 o'clock in the morning, you've got arraignments at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you've got to get everything done by that 2 o'clock, or else the person goes free, or even later in the day. And so if you pushed it to 36, I would always give them a full working day without the jump to 48. But it's just something I'm toying with. It may turn out to be that's impractical, but I want to let her know that I was thinking about that and let you know about that as well. So let's keep going.
Section 12, which it is a conforming statute to change our sentencing statutes to reflect the increases in penalty for unlawful exploitation of a minor and online enticement of a minor. Section 13 is the second statutory reference to 48 hours, and that's in the extradition law. Section 14 and 15 correct two inconsistencies between a law statutes and court rules. Section 14 changes the crime of failure to carry and provide proof of a driver's license from a Class B misdemeanor, which is a B misdemeanor in Title 28, to an infraction. Right now, this offense is a correctable $50 fine in our state bail schedules. So it's a correctable offense. You can go in and show that you had a driver's license, and it will be dismissed.
So that's driving without an operator's license, DWL.
In your possession, right. Even though you have one. And 15 deals with driving without proof of automobile insurance in your possession. And that is a Class B misdemeanor in Title 28, but it's a correctable offense in the bail schedules, and that doesn't make sense. So this was changed to make that also an infraction. Section 16 deals with probation officers. It was redrafted to make it clear that for misdemeanor offenses, the appointment of a probation officer for supervised probation is at the discretion of the Commissioner of Corrections. Section 17 deals with another inconsistency, and that is the inconsistency between burning a vehicle in the Kinnick River. The Kinnick River public use area.
It's in your. I wouldn't have known except for it's in your. Very
thank
good,
you. It's on this one too. Kinnick River public use area was made a in 2006. That public use area was created by the legislature. The statute creating it asked the Department of Natural Resources to adopt regulation for conduct within the use area. And it also specified that violations would be violations and not crimes. One of the regulations adopted by DNR prohibited burning a vehicle in the area, and the bail schedule set a bail of $50 for that offense. 2 years later, the legislature adopted the crime of arson in the third degree, which makes it a Class C felony to burn a vehicle on any public property, municipal or state. So right now it's a C felony to burn a vehicle on state property except in the Kinnick River public use area, and it's a $50 fine in the Kinnick River public use area. The Section 17 corrects this inconsistency. Section 18.
Sorry, I'm running a little slow here. Section 15, what can you explain the rationale for making that an infraction as opposed to a Class B misdemeanor?
Well, it's failure to carry and show proof of automobile insurance. This is not driving without being covered. It's just driving without
the card.
The card in your car.
But if you have the card and you take it in, then you don't get convicted, right?
That's correct. But, you know, several years ago, in the last 5 years, the legislature adopted this mandatory $500 fine for the offense. I agree with you. It's a little puzzling who would not bring their proof of insurance in to avoid a mandatory fine, but it was felt by the legislature that that ought to be a mandatory fine for that offense if a person doesn't bring in proof of insurance.
Senator Pascoe.
What's the maximum jail time for a Class B misdemeanor?
Through the chair, 90 days.
And you kind of ladder up, what's for a Class A misdemeanor?
1 year.
So, and the reason why, you know, the arrest without warrant in Section 13 is imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. So am I reading that accurately, that you would not be arrested for a B misdemeanor or even an A misdemeanor if the A misdemeanor is capped at 1 year? What is...
I'm sorry, I'm not following you. What section are you talking about?
Page 8, line 22, where it's it says, or imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year.
Through the chair, this deals with arrest without warrant of people who are wanted in other states, and there's a fugitive warrant that is found by a law enforcement officer in our state. We don't extradite people for misdemeanors. That's what it's talking about.
Well, maybe getting back to an arrest in the 24 versus 48 hours, can someone be arrested for a Class B misdemeanor and held for 48 hours? That's kind of what I'm wondering.
They wouldn't be under this section, but it's unlike, because this is for extraditions.
But I'm getting back to the general concept of 24 versus 48 hours.
It's unlikely, but it's possible. It's unlikely because when you're arrested for a misdemeanor, there's very often a bail schedule for release. You don't have to, and there are other things that they're less complicated offenses, which means that paperwork can be gotten to the district attorney a lot faster for a misdemeanor than it would be for a felony. Mm-hmm. So although it's possible, but you know, we still would have to. And actually, to be perfectly frank, it sometimes happens that when people are arrested for misdemeanors, they are too intoxicated to be arraigned within 24 hours, and they have to take them back to jail and bring them back again. So it is possible it can happen, but it is unlikely just because misdemeanors are a lot less complicated in terms of charging than felonies are.
And I understand that, and I'm just concerned about an overzealous, you know, law officer, and there's a trial in Fairbanks going on right now that deals with up on the Charlie River, and so I guess that's just why it's coming to mind now, is that if you were potentially chargeable of a Class B misdemeanor, that you could be arrested, brought into jail, spend 24 hours, and ultimately, like with the not carrying your insurance card, it's basically just prove you got your insurance card, and there's nothing else mm-hmm. other than that. So, I mean, I'm struggling now with the concept of if you're a Class B misdemeanor, you know, how long should you sit in jail if there's essentially no penalty that you pay?
Oh, well, by changing it to an infraction, it means that you wouldn't be arrested.
No, I understand that it's okay. Reducing it to an infraction, mm-hmm. but right now it would be a crime that they could be arrested and brought to jail for.
Mm-hmm. That's within the discretion of the arresting officer. Right. Usually, the person arrested doesn't give proof of identification, they're cited for most misdemeanors anyway. Of course, it depends on the circumstances, but that's within the discretion of the arresting officer.
Senator Lukowski.
Yeah, and I'll just a comment, but I've said it before. I am always very wary of giving discretion to prosecutors and giving discretion to the police when they're taking away people's liberties and people's rights. And so I guess I share Senator Pasvan's concerns in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of goes throughout the entire bill, where we're extending the right of government to take away people's liberties, and that has always concerned me, particularly when we're giving more discretion to people to our government to throw people in jail. That's just a concern that I've had for a number of years, and I continue to have that concern.
And a fair concern. With respect to the amount of time we have left, let's have Ms. Carpinetti finish the overview, and I'd ask the committee to hold their questions. We do have a visitor that I want to make sure we have plenty of time for, and so let's just go ahead and finish our overview. There'll be plenty of time to discuss the bill before the committee's ready to take final action.
The last section is a redraft of the administrative subpoena section that was also passed last year in the bail. No, it was in the sexual offense statute that was adopted last year, SB 222. We encountered numerous problems with the way it was drafted, and I think it was probably because we in the criminal division don't do subpoenas a lot. It took us a while to figure out the best way to do it. And there's some provisions in here that I will just briefly describe. It changes the method of service because the service that was provided in the last year's bill made it slower than, I mean, the whole purpose of having an administrative subpoena is to get information from an ISP in a fashion that's fast enough so that the police can go get a warrant to search a particular computer. And the service provisions made it slower than getting a search warrant, actually. Various other things, delegation, I know that's a concern of the chair, and what happens to the information if it's not used in a criminal investigation. The last year's provision provided that it either be returned to the ISP or destroyed. That's sort of impractical because the ISP doesn't need it. They have the information, and it's probably not a good idea for government to destroy records. They can seal it. They can make it part of a confidential file that people don't have access to, but destroying records isn't something that government should be doing. I do have Derek DeGraff is here, and he
we will talk about that. That's section 18. Actually, why don't we go ahead and stop there, because that is probably the provision we're going to speak to Mr. Sergeant DeGraff about the subpoenas. So that's a good break point. Thank you so much, Ms. Carpinetti.
Thank you.
Sergeant, do you want to come forward? Welcome to the committee. Nice to have you back in Juneau. Thanks for making the trip down. Put yourself on the record.
Hi, my name is Derek DeGraff, and I am a state trooper. I supervise the state trooper's technical crimes unit, which is essentially a cyber crimes investigation unit and part of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force for Alaska.
And did I recall correctly that you are a sergeant?
I am.
Good. Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Well, I'd just like to make some brief comments on some of these statutes, just kind of my overall thoughts, and maybe kind of paint the picture on a few types of cases and how they work and why we think and why we support the amendment that's in front of you here. And just try and give you the street view, I guess, of how this would work versus the 30,000-foot view and trying to figure out some of this stuff here. So if you bear with me, I'd like to just kind of go through, and maybe that will generate some questions maybe for the end.
Sure.
If that would be acceptable. First one that I'd like to talk about is on page 2, dealing with the online enticement of a minor and raising that penalty up a felony level. The online enticement crime itself, you probably are most familiar with it when you see the Catch a Predator television show, where you have a police officer or detective or investigator pretending to be a 14, 15, 13-year-old kid on the internet, is allured by the bad guy to meet for sex. That's essentially what it is. And in those cases where law enforcement pretends to be those folks, you know, in our mind it's one of those good saves, because that crime is essentially a precursor to several other much more serious offenses. That meeting essentially turns into one of a few things. It could turn into a sexual abuse of a minor situation for second, third degree, more serious offenses than the online enticement itself. It can turn into a production of child pornography, the unlawful exploitation statute, which also we're asking to raise up a felony level. Some of these turn into homicides where the kids are killed. Sometimes they're found, sometimes they're not. And lastly, that's just one of those things. You can't ever take away that child's innocence if this sort of crime is perpetrated. And so from my point of view, we look at these kids as the most vulnerable. You know, and some of them, you know, we're not necessarily talking about the 17, 18-year-olds so much as the kids that are under 16 that can't give consent. So we're very passionate about this bill and raising both the first-time offense and the second. You know, I've been there when we've pretended to be the police officer, you know, the bad guy, and we're the police officer, and you get to chase the bad guy across the parking lot and tackle him and take him to jail, and we prevented that from happening to a real kid. Unfortunately, these come in more often as, you know, a parent calls us and say, hey, you know, my daughter just came home, this is what's happened, and we were too late. We weren't able to get online and pretend to be that 14-year-old, that 15-year-old, and that those things happen. So that first-time offender to us is just as bad as the second-time offender. You've probably seen on that television show, you get they've had the same guy show up more than once on a different episode where they recognize him, and he had been lured there the first time and dealt with, and he came back. So they are coming back, so it's important to have that second-time offender, and we've seen that happen. But it's important to us for that first-time offender. Moving along to the sexting bill, we get quite a few. I don't have a good number to give you, but we do get quite a few calls, mostly from parents, sometimes school officials, talking about, hey, you know, usually it's girls actually tend to take more photos of themselves and provide them to a quote-unquote boyfriend at the time, and then a week or a month have gone by, the relationship sours, and now he is sending them by email to everybody that she knows or posting them to an online site. You've probably seen in the news some of those situations have caused the suicide of the person that was photographed. So it's important to deal with it. Right now, for the most part, we can't do anything unless that image rises to the level of a child pornography image. So we think it's important to have that law in effect. Touching briefly on page 5 on the misconduct involving confidential information, if you're ever interested in kind of seeing what this is Google search credit card skimmer. These things are available on the internet for $100, $200. They fit in your pocket. All it takes is a credit card, driver's license, somebody working behind the counter at a Burger King. I've seen this happen. I've worked a case, in Wasilla where the guy working behind the counter was skimming credit cards. This is exactly what he was doing, is he was obtaining this confidential information. And fortunately, the person saw what happened, reported it, police responded, we were able to deal with it. But we want to make that initial skimming, that initial getting the information before he sold it or used it, a crime to prevent it from going that far. So that's why we think this is also important. There's also newer technology in credit cards and passports where you can be walking down the street, and if somebody has essentially an RFID scanner, they can be within a foot of you, not even have to really touch you, but they can get the information off your passport or your credit card without your knowledge, right out of your pocket. They didn't pickpocket you figuratively, they did it electronically. So we want to make sure that those types of things are stopped up here in Alaska.
I'm sorry that Senator McGuire is not here, because she, if you say RFID, she wants to talk to you about the bill she proposed a couple of years ago to narrow their usage. Please continue.
At the bottom of page 5 with this 48-hour arrest thing here, extending that, one of the things, I don't know if it's been brought up before, was there are times, and they're rare, they're not that often, where us as law enforcement, especially with specific major crime investigations, we actually have to time the arrest based upon this 24-hour window. And sometimes it can go to the extreme where we might actually, by not arresting the person, be creating our own public safety problem by waiting because of this window that we have. It doesn't happen very often. It's usually narrow to large conspiracies and very large case investigations. But there are some rare circumstances where this 48 hours is very important to us. And for our rural troopers that are out there with the weather delays, that typically, as previously I think talked about, weather can be usually the biggest factor sometimes with the this arrest window. So I just wanted to talk briefly about that. And I'll just move right to the admin subpoena law here. And this is what I'm most passionate about. I think
we're on
page 9, line 20. The reason for wanting this provision is essentially to take more child predators off the street. It helps us quickly identify accounts. It helps us resolve essentially IP addresses to a physical location. That's all that this is doing. We still are required to get a search warrant to be able to go contact a person and seize their computer or go to their house and make entry into their house to talk to somebody, conduct that criminal investigation. But this, I know that most of the committee here has seen the staggering statistics of folks specifically in Alaska that are essentially sharing child pornography. Some are creating it, distributing it on the internet. And we have, between the Alaska State Troopers and the Anchorage Police Department, we have both have a couple folks full-time. All they do are try and catch typically men that are sharing child pornography. And this is going to be a very powerful tool to help us. It'll speed up cases. It'll allow us to catch more bad guys. It will save us time. It will help protect more children. And so this is a very important tool. It was supported last year. So I would just ask for your continued support with that amendment as well.
Yeah, as I recall, when Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, and I visited your headquarters very strong presentation there, very fascinating, very gritty work you're engaged in, I think you got our undying respect for just being able to do that work day after day. That comes from me. My recollection was that the point of the subpoena was to link an ISP address to a physical address. That was the sort of the missing link that you really needed help with. Once you located a house where the computer was, you were going to, either get a search warrant or not, depending on how the case went forward. Is that about right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is exactly correct. We're able to identify hundreds of IP addresses in Alaska. Right now, we have to obtain a search warrant for every one of them. And that takes a significant amount of time.
And what was, and if you can just describe sort of what the hang up was with the bill we passed. I mean, what was the problem?
If I recall correctly from memory, the first problem was the service of it. Right now, we had to, how it was written, excuse me, last year, was that it actually had to come from the Attorney General himself versus a designee. And he obviously doesn't have time to be reviewing these, signing off on these, and getting them processed. So I think that was the biggest hang-up. We wanted, in this new bill, to make sure that he had a proper designee within the Department of Law, independent of the investigation, to be able to sign off on one of these subpoenas. I believe the second, more minor issue was the service of it and having to follow some civil summons, subpoena service issues versus a search warrant, whereas we can email that, fax that, or deliver it in person. So we wanted to be able to do those same things.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, yeah, we were there. I was there as well. Certainly sympathetic to the problem. A huge problem in Alaska. Is there anywhere else in law, in criminal law, where we allow the Attorney General or his designee issue a subpoena? Do you know? And maybe you don't know that, but...
I'd have to ask Mrs. Carpinetti.
I can recall from last year's floor speech, and the distinction is important, so let's just set aside the criminal law issue for a second. In last year's floor speech, when I was asked to carry the bill, if it was last year, I pointed out, I think, a half a dozen other instances where the commissioners are authorized to issue subpoenas. Commissioner of Labor can issue subpoenas. Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources can issue subpoenas. Committees can issue subpoenas. It's fairly... broadly given power. What I haven't looked into is, A, do we allow the Commissioner of the Department of Labor or his designee to issue a subpoena, and whether those that, and more importantly, your question, I think, is whether that information is likely to lead to a criminal prosecution. That's the distinction that's on my mind.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll just, again, voice my concern with giving, you know, not only the Attorney General, but now we're giving some designee the right to basically go and search and seize someone's property.
Well, again, I don't think we're seizing anything, but I share your concerns, and don't mean to change it. The one I'm just considering, and thinking about making this like the Deputy Attorney General in charge of the criminal division, because the Attorney General's designee could be that person, or it could be anybody. I mean, just his designee. So I think I want to find a way to narrow that to still make it workable. Senator Pascal.
You know, following up along that line of questioning, what is the amount of time difference between obtaining a subpoena from a Superior Court judge as compared to the Attorney General?
Senator, through the chair, currently, right now, if I were to get an IP address that I knew had reasonable suspicion or probable cause that was involved with the production or distribution of those child pornography images, I would sit down and start writing a search warrant for it. And our search warrant affidavits are typically about 15 to 20 to 23 pages long. And that documents the whole technology section, laying out how we're able to come to the conclusion that we have, the flow of the investigation up to that point. So that takes typically, I've averaged it to maybe about 3 to 4 hours on a typical case of writing that up, preparing it, getting ready to go, having a peer review it, making sure I can now walk down or drive to the courthouse and go see a judge. Going to see a judge might take me an hour for them to sit down, review the whole thing, read it, sign off onto it, get numbers, come back. So that's a typical investigation right now to do that. And that's just assuming I sat down and started it right then and there. A summons or a subpoena specifically might take me 10 minutes to fill out the form that the Department of Law would have that I would have to submit for review and getting it signed off from this designee. And then they would in turn email it back to me, and then I could send it right by email to the Internet service provider. What we do when we identify an IP address is we immediately contact the Internet service provider and say, hey, FYI, we're going to be serving a search warrant soon on this. Please gather the data, get it ready for us, so as soon as we show up, they can turn it over and we can go run and do our thing to help speed it up. So right, this would save maybe 4 or 5 hours per case as I see it right now.
If I'm understanding, you're talking about a form document for the Attorney General's office, why couldn't you do a similar form document for the court?
Because the court requires the search warrant and the probable cause statement versus this is going to be the reasonable suspicion. It's a lesser level, the explanation. I don't have to have all those definitions and explanation of all the background technology in it that the court likes to see, that our prosecutors like to see. So the amount of data that I have to type and write up is significantly less on a subpoena. I've seen subpoenas from other states and federal agencies, and most of them are one-page forms that they fill out and can send in. And all that does is that business record that we're getting from the Internet service provider is just essentially translating the IP address to a physical address. That's when essentially the real investigation begins, and we have to develop our probable cause, still go get a search warrant to be able to enter the house, do all those things. There's quite a few states that already have this, so we're kind of modeling after this trend of being able to better identify, better target the folks that are doing this. The other thing I can say is not every case where we would get a subpoena for somebody would necessarily end up in a criminal investigation. If I have 10 IP addresses from one day's worth of investigation, I want to try and identify the registered sex offender. I want to identify the school teacher or the nurse or the person that's in a position of authority and target that person versus maybe the 18-year-old that has child pornography versus somebody that, in my mind, needs to be dealt with a lot quicker and be in that position of authority. So this would certainly help us better qualify the leads that we have and I guess give us a better idea of who we're dealing with.
Senator Pascal.
is the intent that if you were to receive this Attorney General issued subpoena, that you would then potentially, with the information you receive from the provider, then go to the judge to get a search warrant, or how would that process?
Yes, if this process was in place, in fact, people in my office that are federal agents do what we're trying to do right now, and how the process goes is when I get the subpoena back with the address of, you know, 123 Main Street, then they have to go out, drive by the house, confirm that the name they got from the internet service provider matches the borough or the city records, the tax records, the license plate on the car in the driveway, all those things like a normal police investigation. We have to go get a search warrant then. That allows us to go and enter that residence or business, whatever it may be, to seize computers for the investigation.
Yeah, just for clarity, what you can, the total universe of what you can get out of this subpoena is on page 9, lines 31, the name and identifying information. Next page, the address of physical location, and length of service, start date, types of service. That's it. That's all you can get. You're not going to get a file. You're not going to get a computer. You're not going to get a house, a disk, or nothing. You're going to just get that information. Senator Pazman.
No, and I appreciate that, but again, I'm going back to if you've done the paperwork, that 3 hours or so, the paperwork, when you go to the court, do you get a subpoena to access the records and a search warrant?
Like how we do it right now?
Yes.
Right now it's a two search warrant process.
Yep. Search warrant for the data you're looking for here, and then a search warrant if it leads to something for the computer. Okay. I'm afraid we are out of town, but I really appreciate you being here. It makes it a great presentation, and thank you for traveling down here. If we have more questions, we will get you online. But again, thanks so much for your hard work, and if there's nothing further from the committee, we're adjourned.